Hi, I'm Mike from Chicago. The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like you and me. If you'd like to donate to support the show, please visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate. You'll be glad you did.
I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart, and this is the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. Hey, welcome to the Sound of Young America radio, friends. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. On this week's Sound of Young America broadcast, three folks who are practicing some serious anti-hegemonic cultural production. That's American Studies talk for sticking it to the man. A little bit later on in the program, we'll talk with Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler. They're the founding editors of Bitch Magazine, the subtitle of which is A Feminist Response to Popular Culture. They're celebrating their 10th anniversary with the publication of a book called Bitch Fest, which compiles some of the best essays from the first 10 years of the magazine. And in just a minute, we'll talk with Maz Jobrani. Maz is headlining the Axis of Evil comedy tour, which brings together a group of three Middle Eastern stand-up comedians. He's also one of the co-stars of the upcoming television sitcom The Knights of Prosperity, which has already received some rave reviews from the critics out there. That's all to come on this week's Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. We'll be back in just a second. My guest, Maz Jobrani, is a stand-up comedian and actor. He's been seen in films like The Interpreter and Friday After Next on television and in Curb Your Enthusiasm and on 24, and he's one of the stars of the upcoming ABC sitcom The Knights of Prosperity. He's currently on the road with the all-Middle Eastern American Axis of Evil comedy tour. I spoke with him from a rented home in New York where he was working on the show. Let's start by talking about this tour that you're on. This Axis of Evil comedy tour is, this is sort of an odd duck. I think some of the other, it's obviously in some ways in the mold of, the Kings of Comedy or the Blue Collar comedy tour. But those are comedians doing specifically targeted acts at a very specifically targeted demographic. Whereas what you're doing with this Axis of Evil comedy tour is, you know, similarly themed, but I can't imagine that you're really touring the country on the back of the, you know, Arab American comedy audience.
No, you're right. Actually, I always use the term Middle Eastern American because that includes, like, you know, Iranians and Arabs, and even going further, you could include, you know, Indians and other Eastern countries there. But yeah, actually, one of our goals with doing this is to cross over to a more general American population crowd. And we actually, a lot of our shows, like we just did a show in D.C., it was 1,800 people were there, and I'd say about 60% was Middle Eastern, 40% was just like white American. And that's the thing, is that we get a lot of support from the Middle Eastern community because there just has not been, I mean, you can't name a Middle Eastern American comedian there's no name, there's never been anyone that anyone knows of, and especially given the times and the way Middle Easterners are depicted, and you know, the first word, I've tried this on stage before, I said, you know, what do you think of when you hear the word Middle East? And people say war, terrorism, right off the bat. And so you go, oh, great, that's our image. So that's the thing, is that we're trying to do stand-up and, you know, and cross over and have people come to our shows and go, oh, that guy was funny, and he was Middle Eastern, and he didn't throw a rock at me or try and blow anything up. Whoa, that's kind of cool.
Are you guys representative of some kind of scene in the comedy world? Is there a Middle Eastern American comedy world that you're bringing to people, or are you sort of creating it?
You know, that's an interesting question. I guess we're kind of at the forefront here, because what happened was the way we all got together was about 6 years ago, before September 11th. Mitzi Shore, who's the owner of the Comedy Store and Pauly Shore's mother, she had me as a regular at the Comedy Store. I was her only Middle Eastern comic there. And then she came up with an idea of putting together a show with Middle Eastern comedians. And that's when she found Ahmed Ahmed, and I'd seen Aaron Kader, so I recommended him to be a regular at the club, and he did. He performed in front of her, became a regular. Then we brought on Sam Tripoli. There was a handful of us, and at that point it was what I just told you. It was like every like ethnicity that is even related to the Middle East or can be mistaken for, like, in this whole war on terror thing. Like, she had like an Indian on the show. Sam Tripoli was like half Armenian. It was just like anything that kind of fit it. So we kind of came together, and she called it the Arabian Nights. And we started doing shows as the Arabian Nights. And one of the things was what I just said earlier, was that Iranians aren't Arabs. So a lot of times we do these shows, and Iranians would come up afterwards. They say, "Oh, it was great. We had a great time. Very good. Thank you so much for a fun time." But, you know, Iranians are not Arabs. And I was like, "Yeah, I know. But, you know, in the minds of, you know, the world, we kind of all fall in the same category." And so we just used the Arabian Nights name for a while, and did well. And then after a while, then Aaron Ahmed and I, Aaron is Palestinian-American, Ahmed is Egyptian-American, we decided to go with the name the Axis Evil Comedy Show. It had been a name we'd thrown around before, and we liked the statement that it made. In my mind, it makes a statement that it's basically taking that term that George Bush gave to that part of the world and kind of turning it on its head by putting the word comedy behind it. Because in my opinion, it's a total joke. Because if you break it down, you know, why is it that Iran and North Korea and Iraq ended up in this quote-unquote axis of evil when you have other countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, where some of the terrorists came from? Not to say that they should have been in it. I'm just saying there's a lot more behind why these countries ended up where they ended up in this name. And secondly, when George Bush says it's the governments I have a problem with, in reality, even if he says that, unfortunately the people suffer from these countries. And so we did. We've kind of, I think we're at the forefront in creating this kind of new thing. You know, there's another tour out there called the Allah Made Me Funny Tour, but they're not all Middle Eastern. One's a Pakistani comic, the other one's an African American comedian. They're more based on the Muslim thing that brings them together. But yeah, it's new, man. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's pretty new in terms of just being Middle Eastern based. You know,
I've talked to comedians who are not white and play ethnically themed shows, and a lot of times they tell me they have kind of mixed feelings about it. You know, on the one hand, obviously being very proud of their ethnicity and proud to be able to play to an audience that will, largely understand the cultural references they're making and things like that. But on the other hand, also kind of not necessarily always comfortable with the idea of being pigeonholed by their ethnicity. What's your feeling about that?
You know, I think that it's funny because early on, actually, Sam Tripoli and I were talking, and he said, you know, you want to be a comedian that happens to be Iranian, not an Iranian comedian. And I agree with him. And I think that as a person, I'm 34 years old, I'm married, I have a lot of other things that I can talk about, and I do talk about in my stand-up. And I think as a writer and as a creator, we need to expand on other aspects of ourselves. Now, the problem that I keep running into is such a heated political time that even if I weren't Iranian, there's a lot of political stuff I want to talk about. So when I read the newspapers, and I hear that, you know, the president of Iraq came to America and made a speech in front of Congress and was saying that Iraq is fine, everything's going well. And I'm thinking to myself, is it really? Like, is this just this is a politician speaking, and it's like, are these guys, like, out of their minds? Like, are they reading the same newspapers I am? Or, like, when I hear that Donald Rumsfeld, somebody asked him, is it a civil war over there? And he started hemming and hawing and going, well, you know, define civil war. Like, what do you mean? And I'm like, come on, man. So I think it's a comedian's job to expose hypocrisy as much as we can. And so, but it feels like these days a lot of that falls into this Middle Eastern category when I see what's going on in the world. So I end up talking about that stuff a lot. And yeah, I also would like to talk about other issues and the sort, but a lot of, especially if I'm in front of one of these, like if we're doing an Access Evil comedy show where I know that there is a charged kind of Middle Eastern crowd that wants to hear some political stuff, wants to hear positive stuff about the Middle East, then I just go for it and I have a blast, and it's great to have these people on board. I mean, our show in D.C., you know, D.C. is the, you know, political heart of America, and it's great to just do a show in front of 1,800 people, and, you know, one of the other comics, Dino Badala, who performs with us, made a reference to Ann Coulter, and they all got it with no problem. I mentioned the name John Bolton, and I didn't have to go through the explanation of, you know, the American ambassador to the United Nations. It was just John Bolton, and they got it. You know, it's great to have that that in front of these kinds of audiences. I also end up doing shows where, you know, whether it's at the Comedy Store in L.A. or the Comedy Cellar here in New York, where it's a mixed crowd, and sometimes you get a little too heavy on your ethnicity, and you see that you've lost this crowd, and then part of you goes, well, I need more jokes that'll cross over, and then part of you goes, well, maybe they need to be more informed about who I am, and I got to kind of stick to my guns and push it. So, you know, it goes both ways. I don't want to, like, I learned early on I would get booked at some clubs that were bars, and I would go out and I'd be wanting to work on material, and then I'd end up having to do, you know, boob jokes and stuff because they didn't want to hear anything about politics. And I learned early on that I did not want to be that guy. I don't want to necessarily please every crowd. I want to have my voice and then hopefully be able to have different crowds understand me.
When you're on the road as a comedian, you're working with lots and lots and lots of other comedians, and in a comedy store show, you know, you're working with a lot more than two other comedians often. Do you see a lot of Middle Eastern stereotypes that are still sort of de rigueur in contemporary American comedy?
Absolutely, and it's funny. I was just talking to, again, Dino Badal, and he was telling me he saw some comic who was doing jokes, you know, an American comic doing jokes about the Middle East, and he said that, you know, the guy was, like, using an Indian accent, but he was talking, he was trying to be an Arab, and then he was just, like, mixing it all up and just putting all together, everyone together. And that's the thing, is that it's very specific, the differences. And I mean, you know, even like, you know, after September 11th, when Indian Sikhs were being shot, who have nothing to do with that, you know, that world of terrorism and the sort, in terms of what had happened on September 11th, and people think that, okay, if you wear a turban, then you're a bad guy, and that's it. And I think that a lot of people, you know, I live in L.A. now, so there's a lot of Iranians there, so a lot of people in L.A. have been exposed to the Iranian culture, but a lot of people haven't. And if you go to other parts of the country, even more people don't know what the Middle Eastern cultures are all about. And so I do run into that, and I see comics doing some joke, and it just, you know, and they say, oh, and the guy, you know, the turban dude or whatever, just simplifying it a little too much. And I want to go up on stage and clarify it to people and go, no, this isn't the case, you know. And again, it's the situation where we have an issue in the world with, you know, the Middle Eastern extremists that might be, that are going around and actually, you know, doing terrorist acts, that are a minority number-wise, if you look at it, number-wise, they're a minority amongst all Middle Easterners and also Muslims in the world. But that is the stereotype that people always talk about. And so that's kind of, you know, I also make jokes about it, but at the same time, I try and be as specific and I try and be as clear as possible. I've even had people come up to me afterwards and, like, correct me on certain things. You know, whether it was I was talking about the Academy Awards and there was no Arabs there, and someone goes, Selma Hayek, and I go, what? And they go, yeah, she's half Lebanese or whatever, half Lebanese or Palestinian or something. And I was like, oh wow, okay, you learn something on every show, I guess.
You're listening to The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. My guest is Maz Jobrani. We'll be back with more with Maz, that's a mouthful, in just 1 minute. You know, The Sound of Young America is supported by listener donations, and it doesn't take a large donation to make a large difference. On our website, we ask for donations of $2, $5, or $10 a month. I think you can probably swing that, and if you really like the sound of Young America, I'd love to have you do it. It makes a huge difference for the program. I haven't taken home a dollar from the sound of Young America. I do it because I love it. All our money goes to buy things like mixing boards and microphones and stuff like that. So visit MaximumFun.org and donate today. You're listening to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My guest, Maz Jobrani, is an actor and stand-up comedian. He's currently on tour with the Axis of Evil comedy tour. He's also going to be on the ABC sitcom, The Knights of Prosperity. What about these ethnic variations? I mean, I watched your acting reel on your website.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're a guy who grew up in Marin County, right, in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And of the roles that you have, there are a few that are clearly, could very well be Iranian-American guy. Or, you know, just American guy that happens to also be Iranian-American. But you also have, you know, a lot of roles where you're playing, you know, your role on Curb Your Enthusiasm, for example, you're playing a Sikh.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of roles that you're just playing the kind of vaguely Middle Eastern guy. How do you feel about that when you're like going out on auditions and auditioning for a lot of roles that are... I presume just kind of, I mean, even on The Knights of Prosperity, which I've already spoken very highly of, your character is a cab driver.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, it's funny because people look at it on the face, on the surface, and they go, oh, man, another ethnic, another stereotype, you're playing a cab driver. And I go, well, no, I go, look, you know, there's a lot of other things involved. First of all, as an actor, you want to be involved with good writing, and this show, Knights of Prosperity, has good writing. The opportunity to work on Curb Your Enthusiasm was great to do, you know, a show with these guys that are at the top of their game, or playing a Saudi ambassador on the West Wing. I mean, there's all these opportunities to work with great people and great writing. That's number one. Number two is, for example, you know, even in this show, The Knights of Prosperity, they talk about how this character that I played, Guri Shankar Subramaniam, was a lawyer back in India, and now he's here driving a cab, driving old ladies to matinees, as they say in the show. Well, you know, I take the cab all the time in New York, and there's a lot of those types of people who were, you know, I met a guy who was a PhD in Egypt, and now he's driving a cab here. And that's a reality, and that's also something that I can relate to in terms of, like, okay, I've met people like that, or I know people like that. I have relatives of mine who came from Iran and took jobs in positions they never would have taken. And so I go, okay, that I can understand. What I've tried to do is I've tried to steer away from the stereotype of playing any terrorist parts. And I had done that on a Chuck Norris movie once, and it was like, it was the worst experience. It was stupid. And I now have a bit out of it, so that's good. At least as a comedian, you get a bit out of it. And then I also did it on the TV show 24, where I played the ambivalent terrorist in the season 2, and, like, you know, halfway through the episode, I was like, I don't want to do this, and then they shot me, and I was like, okay, that sucks. But what I've said is, I don't want to play any more parts like that, where, because if you want to see Middle Eastern terrorists, just turn on the TV, you see them on the news all the time. But I'm not going to stop playing other parts, because end of the day, I mean, you look at my look, that, you know, I can play a lot of different Middle Eastern parts. I've also played, you know, Latino. There's this movie Moon Pie that hasn't come out yet, but I play a Mexican guy in that. You know, I'd love to be able to play more, you know, like Tony Shalhoub got a chance to play an Italian in The Big Night. I would love to get a chance to do that. Sometimes it just depends on where you are in your career and what kind of opportunities come up. But for me, I have fun playing these parts, you know, and I don't think that it necessarily feeds a negative stereotype when there's a reality. That's more real to me, the Indian cab driver, than playing a terrorist. Again, like I said, I even emphasize in my stand-up that I've never met a terrorist or talked to one, nor do I ever want to meet one. But I have met Indian cab drivers, and so it's easier for me to go, okay, that's more of a reality to me. And I know that people are going to be critical all the time, but, it just, like I said, it's It's a gig that you're having fun doing. The writers, you know, write great stuff. And, I mean, and every character in this show is an underdog. It's the Indian cab driver and the Colombian waitress and the, you know, American janitor and the, you know, the black, you know, bouncer or whatever, security guard. So, yeah, I just think that, you know, you can't just, like, lead your whole career going, I will only play parts that are, you know, men of integrity, you know, lawyers and doctors only, you know.
Have you ever had an occasion where you either went into a job or went into an audition and it left a bad taste in your mouth to the extent that you decided not to participate in it or to leave or to turn down a role?
Yeah, I haven't had the audition actually happen where I ended up leaving with bad taste in my mouth, but I have had, you know, auditions come to me where they said, hey, you know, they're doing another show, you know, or movie or whatever, and it's like a terrorist part, and I've just started turning those down. It's funny, my agent called me up just a little while back, and he goes, hey, I'm getting ready to, because I've told them, I've instructed them that I don't want to do those parts. So he called me up, and he said, hey, I'm getting ready to turn down a role. I just wanted to double check with you. And I said, okay, what is it? He goes, Flight 93. Any more questions? I go, nope, that's fine. And then I said, are there any good parts in there? And he goes, yeah, but they're all for white guys. I said, okay, that's fine. I'm done. So, yeah, I mean, I've, you know, unfortunately, those parts are still out there. And you know, I mean, that's just the reality of it. I can't blame people for writing, you know, a movie about September 11th and the sort. But, you know, I just choose not to participate in those.
Something you alluded to about Knights of Prosperity that impressed me is that it is a program that very much identifies with the underdog and doesn't really paint broad strokes about working class people, which is pretty uncommon, I think, in television. It must have been exciting to have that come across your desk and get that role, which is, I mean, you mentioned the fact that your character was a professional in his past life. There was a wonderful line in the pilot of the series where you draft an intern into this effort to become a criminal gang, and you describe it to the main character as being like white slavery.
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty fantastic. It seems to be very very sincere. It seems to very sincerely identify with working class people in a way that American television, especially the past 20 years or so, hasn't that much.
You know, as an actor, especially with comedy parts, you know, when auditions come up during pilot season, you read a lot of sitcoms, and they tend to be pretty I've never laughed out loud as I was reading one of those scripts. And when I read this script, I was laughing out loud, and I just think that the writers have created these great characters that, you know, we were just talking about this recently while we were shooting, that it's funny that the characters are trying to rob Mick Jagger, and, you know, being a thief is not a good thing necessarily, but these characters are written in such a way that I feel that the audience will root for us because we are the underdogs, and it's just fun. Like I said, what they've done is they've really done it in an equal-handed way as well, where they have this diverse cast, which you don't see on TV that often. You know, that's one of the things I was saying. You know, like Friends, for example, was knocked quite often for being a show in New York City where everybody was just white at the coffee shop. And here we are with a show that has a Middle Eastern guy playing an Indian, but still a Middle Eastern guy, a Latina, an African American, and then you've got Donald Logue playing, you know, just, you know, the white American guy, and then you got Lenny Venito is kind of an Italian-based guy, and then Josh Grassetti, who's the intern. But it's got this diverse cast, and everyone has their weaknesses and strengths, you know. And every week we get our scripts and we read them, and I'm just cracking up at the kind of stuff they're coming up with, you know. And that's the other thing, too, is they haven't made it, for example, again, talking about those stereotypes, like they haven't made my character. I intentionally don't play the character with too thick of an accent in terms of, like, you know, I didn't make him like Hapu where I was like, hello, how are you, what are you doing? It wasn't like that. I intentionally lessened the accent so that, you know, he talks like this, he's still got an accent and of the sort, but it's not over the top. because I didn't want it to be too cartoony. And at the same time, like I said, they're not weak characters either. Like when the Italian guy, Lenny Venito's character, Squatch, you know, says something to me that I don't agree with, I give it back to him. And it's great to have a character that's not sitting there and just taking abuse from someone else, but actually standing up for himself, you know?
Do you think there's any things in this series that Indian American people are going to be coming up to you after shows and complaining about or pointing out?
You know what? I've started to learn that no matter what you say and do, people will come up to you. People have their agendas, and they will come up to you. And there's always someone out there who's going to find you and give you their two cents on it. And I'm sure I will either get letters or, I mean, it'll start off with, "Hey, why do you have an Iranian playing an Indian?" And my mentality on that is that, you know, we're all actors, and, you know, if an actor can come in and do a part, you know, and fit the part for an Iranian better than I can, and this has happened before, then, you know, that guy should take it, whatever his ethnicity is. And I've seen that happen before. And so the same thing goes in this situation. Maybe, you know, I'm sure there's Indian actors that might have, you know, done some parts of it better, but somehow this character and I clicked, so it's like, great, so I was able to get it, and so I'm doing it. But everyone's got their agenda, like I said, and so I'm sure someone will approach me and talk to me about it.
I
have like a Indian member in my new posse, if I can get one. Actually, I'm married to an Indian, so I'll just have her hang out with me.
Well, Maz, thank you so much for taking the time to be on The Sound of Young America. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thanks a lot. It was great to be on here.
Maz Jobrani can be found online at mazjobrani.com. That's mazjobrani.com. You can find out more information about the Axis of Evil Comedy Tour at axisofevilcomedy.com. And the Knights of Prosperity, Maz's new television program, premieres Tuesday, October 17th at 9 on ABC. You're listening to The Sound of Young America. We'll be back in just a second with the founding editors of Bitch Magazine. You're listening to The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. My guests, Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler, are the founding editors of the Bay Area's own Bitch Magazine, which is a feminist look at popular culture. They're celebrating their 10th anniversary with the publication of Bitch Fest, a compendium of writings from the magazine, both theirs and others. Lisa, Andy, welcome to The Sound of Young America. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having us.
So what was the impetus 10 years ago behind starting this magazine? I gather both of you were in your young 20s. Was it wanting to create the place to work that you didn't see on the media landscape?
It was really creating what we wanted to read that we didn't want to see on the media landscape. We were frustrated with women's magazines and with the fact that they were, you know, depressing to read, and the gender messages they were sending out, and, you know, TV, advertising, movies, everything. We just were very, very frustrated with the messages that were being put out there about women and gender and feminism.
It sort of seemed to us that women's media was, and media for young women in particular, was moving backward instead of forward. And at the time, you know, we were 22. We didn't have journalism degrees. We didn't really have a voice, but we did have kind of a passion for the subject matter. And so we were like, well, if we're going to do it, if we want to read this stuff, we're going to have to create it. And assuming that there are other people out there who are interested in this stuff, maybe we'll have an audience.
You said a passion for the subject matter. To what extent do you mean a passion for feminism and women's issues? And to what extent do you mean a passion for popular culture?
Well, popular culture, I mean, that was sort of the genesis of it. I mean, Lisa and I spent a lot of time, you know, we were bored 9-to-5ers, and we spent a lot of time in our free time reading magazines and going to movies and watching TV and talking about it to each other. And, you know, a lot of that talk was actually complaining about how insulting and kind of hackneyed the portrayals of women and girls were.
Yeah, so I would really say both, you know, a passion for the subject matter of pop culture and feminism. I mean, I don't think that we would have chosen to do a magazine that was just about pop culture without the feminist component. And at the same time, you know, pop culture is, you know, known as this kind of guilty pleasure sometimes within feminist circles. And certainly 10 years ago when we started publishing, there was not that much serious pop culture critique going on from a feminist perspective or any other. So it really seemed like, you know, like a big kind of gaping hole because there's so much to say from a feminist and politicized perspective about pop culture, and it just wasn't getting a lot of attention.
Do you feel like there was something in feminist culture or feminist academic culture that led to there being that hole in feminist critique?
I think that pop culture in all, and this, it's not just confined to feminist academia, it's really, you know, there's always been this kind of false distinction between high culture and low culture, mass culture and smart culture, you know, that leads to kind of a disdain on the part of intellectuals toward, you know, mass media. And so I think that that's really, you know, kind of what's behind that.
And tell me about how you decided to find this, the tone that you have in the magazine, which is, I think, very much both both sort of literate and critical in this sort of academic sense, and not afraid to be kind of fun and funny as well. I mean, that seems like something that, you know, you don't find in a lot of criticism.
Well, to us, it was really important to have the subject matter be really accessible, you know, because it's not like there was a lack of feminist and pop culture critique out there, but those tended to be either very academic in the case of pop culture critique and not accessible enough in terms of feminist media. You know, Ms. Magazine, as awesome as it's always been, at the time really wasn't making any effort to court young college-aged readers and rarely addressed pop culture. And so, you know, Lisa and I were both college-educated. We both knew how to sort of throw the jargon around, but that really wasn't our idea in doing this zine. It was to really blend kind of a fun irreverence about our love-hate relationship with pop culture and, you know, a real sense of informed feminist critique that would be accessible to people who didn't necessarily weren't necessarily completely coming from the same place we were. You know, we wanted to really make people, you know, think about media criticism, but also entertain them.
And also, I mean, we wanted it to be fun to write as well as fun to read. So I think that was behind a lot of our sense of humor. Is that's just kind of, you know, how we talk about things, and you know, we didn't want to have to filter ourselves so much.
Was there something about your kind of generational placement that gave you a sort of a unique perspective? Having grown up in a context where, you know, feminism was something that, I don't know, I'm 5 or 6 years younger than you, but feminist theory was something that's reasonably well ensconced, at least in higher education. Was there something that you were able to do that someone who was, you know, a pioneer, let's say, wasn't able to do?
Well, I think, I mean, my mom was a feminist, so, you know, being raised by a feminist and kind of with feminism to some extent in the water, and by that I mean, you know, there are certain feminist principles that really have been absorbed into mainstream culture about just what, you know, kind of basic women's rights. And so I think there's a sense of entitlement that we have because of that. And I mean entitlement in a very positive sense. I mean, often that's a negative word. But that we felt like, well, we've got these opinions and we have the right to air them. And, you know, we want people to listen. And I think that that's something that we didn't have to fight for so much because we were raised with that entitlement that was really given to us by earlier feminists.
I think a lot of people today, like, if they think of feminism or the women's movement, I mean, if anything, they're thinking of, like, reproductive rights, you know, and they have sort of a limited conception of it. What were the issues that you saw in popular culture that, you know, 10 years ago that made you want to get out there and say something?
Well, I think the issues of female representation in pop culture have, in some sense, at that time, were the same as they'd ever been, really. It was just a question of really limited characterizations of women in television, in movies, in music to some extent, or at least how those things were covered by other media. You know, one of the things that we talked about a lot, at least in the early years, was the fact that if there was ever a woman on the cover of Rolling Stone, she had to be in lingerie and kind of have her mouth hanging open and be in this kind of sexualized pose. And there seemed to be no reason for it, you know what I mean? But it was the same kind of representation that women in Rolling Stone got in the 70s. You know, it really hadn't changed. And on TV and in movies to some extent, that was the same thing. You know, you rarely saw strong female leads, really female characters, like in action movies, though this has changed a bit, at that time were really just playing the kind of doting, nervous wife waiting for her husband to save the world and get home. And so we really wanted to point out that these representations were limiting and that, you know, we had something to say about it.
It seems like the sort of mainstream media's line on feminism is almost completely bound up in either, you know, as I mentioned, reproductive rights or these sort of trend stories that either say like feminism is dead, all women, you know, just want to stay home and have babies now, which is obviously both reductive of contemporary mores and of feminism, that it would be against that. Or, you know, or that there's this new post-feminist movement that means such and such a thing. And it seems like that's something that, that comes up a number of times in the book, the way that the mainstream media shapes these kind of odd stories of what feminism is about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing about the mainstream media is that very few people within it are really making the effort to look at feminist activism and feminist thought and actual feminists who are really doing stuff out there on a grassroots level. They tend to glom onto, as you said, trend stories about marriage and work and kind of scapegoat feminism. And, you know, and then, you know, politicians often add to this, you know, like when Rick Santorum was being interviewed by George Stephanopoulos and made reference to radical feminists having, you know, made women, you know, run out to work and neglect their families, but then he actually couldn't name one of these so-called radical feminists. I mean, that's the thing. They're really bound up in the idea of feminism as this evil, but very unclear about defining its terms and what's actually happening. So, yeah, it's very unfortunate, and I think the main problem is that feminism is really seen in the mainstream media as a zero-sum game. And so what's good for women is inevitably painted as being bad for men. And that's just how they like to play it. And it's very, very frustrating.
Do you guys, do you encounter, it's funny, like that's the third time I've said you guys, one in one of the essays
yeah.
in the book is about the is about the gender neutralization of the phrase you guys and the kind of way that that's sort of fraught with peril.
But we also, I mean, you know, unless you're going to say y'all, It's hard, I mean.
Or use. That's a good one. If you're from the East Coast especially, you can get away with that.
So do usins encounter encounter people who are uncomfortable with the idea of being painted as a feminist or uncomfortable with that feminist baggage that you just described, that sort of Rick Santorum idea of feminism? And if so, how do you address that as, you know, as people who are self-professed feminists?
Well, I don't feel like I run into people who are afraid of the label. And I think that may really just say something about the people that I end up meeting, you know, out here in kind of the Bay Area progressive bubble, but also through, you know, through the work that we're doing. You know, we tend to meet people who are not afraid to call themselves feminists. I think that, by and large, our readership is not afraid, you know, to call themselves feminists. But the word still does have an incredibly strong negative connotation. And I think, actually, Andy can probably speak to this one better. I know you have more thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, it's... It's really unfortunate. The reactions, I think, on an anecdotal level, the reactions I get are sort of, nobody has ever come out and been like, well, you know, I'm not a feminist. But you do encounter people who are sort of intrigued by the idea of the magazine and by the idea of a magazine that, you know, is about pop culture and about women. But, you know, you can sort of physically see a little bit of a look of discomfort flicker across people's faces sometimes. And, you know, people who work with us have stories about it, too. We have a board member who's a lawyer, and she has been our attorney and done a lot of pro bono work for us. And she has, in the past, drafted coworkers into helping her on projects. And invariably, one of them will say something like, oh, is this a man-hating magazine? And it sounds to me like a sort of automatic response, like they don't know what else to say because they hear feminist and they think, oh, it must really be anti-male. And we've had men come up to us at events where we table with the magazine and they sort of say, you know, kind of half-jokingly, oh, I'm a man, can I read this magazine? And, you know, my reaction is always sort of to be like, I don't know, can you? It's just one of those things, like, it's hard to know how to respond because you don't want to be kind of overly serious and dogmatic and be like, well, feminism is really for everybody. But at the same time, it's a little bit frustrating because I often feel, gosh, you know, haven't we just gotten beyond this? But it's true. Feminism has a very, 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 very tenacious image problem. And as much stuff as we do to kind of defang it, there are always going to be people who immediately leap to their kind of primal word association.
But that's always been part of the mission of the magazine as well, is to counteract those negative messages about not just about women, but about feminism, and to, you know, to be out there with the humor and with all of the other sorts of things that people don't think can be part of feminism, but to, you know, basically we're trying to help feminism's image problem, and I didn't say that very well.
Another thing that you're trying to help with an image problem is the word bitch. That's a pretty powerful choice. I mean, I guess it's something that helped your zine stand out on the shelves, you know, at Modern Times Books on Valencia Street in 1996. But tell me about why you made that choice to name the magazine that.
Well, with bitch, there was never any other title on the table.
And why would there be, right?
Well, you know, it's funny because there are, you know, at the time, and there certainly still are, feminist magazines out there, and they're really identifiable as feminist magazines. You know, you hear a title like Lilith or Sojourner or, you know, obviously Ms., and you sort of immediately know what you're getting. And we felt like with Bitch, there could be a little bit of intrigue there if someone saw it on the bookshelf and didn't automatically know what it was. Just the power of the word might be enough to attract them. And, you know, not that we were trying to do a bait and switch, but we thought, you know, the more readers, the better. And the more readers who aren't already sort of on our bandwagon, that would be great.
Well, at the same time, we always were really careful and remain really careful about pairing the main title with the subtitle, which is Feminist Response to Pop Culture, because we don't want there to be any misunderstanding, you know, about where we're coming from with the word bitch. But it also, I mean, you know, that's a word that's hurled at women who are outspoken and won't back down from their opinions. And, you know, we really wanted the magazine to be like that. And we also wanted to take the sting out of the word that way. It's kind of like, if you're going to try to insult me by saying that I'm opinionated, well, you know, that's just not going to work because I know I'm opinionated and I'm pretty happy about it.
And that's not a bad thing. And women should not be made to feel that being opinionated is a bad thing. And that's, you know, unfortunately, the word bitch is still really readily used in that way. And, so, unfortunately, we haven't single-handedly managed to conquer it.
That would be quite the nifty trick. For
it really would be.
For the magazine with the readership of 50,000.
It's true. Yeah.
Well, you know, we talk about our goal being world domination, and, you know, we're kind of kidding, but, you know, we're getting there.
You're listening to The Sound of Young America. My guests are Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler, the founding editors of Bitch Magazine. We'll be back with more with Lisa and Andy in just 1 minute. brand new shipment of Sound of Young America t-shirts is here. That's right. Our shirts have been so popular that I had to reorder them. They're now also available in men's small, along with medium large, extra large, double extra large, and women's sizes. They're all printed on super high quality American Apparel t-shirts, and they're only $16 shipped. So visit MaximumFun.org and buy one today. Odds are it'll be the best decision you make in your entire life. It's the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org. With me are Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler of Bitch Magazine. So what's going on now in 2006? What are the themes that are coming up in the magazine? Perhaps themes that are more prevalent now than they were when you started 10 years ago.
Well, I mean, we've changed in the sense that we, you know, the writing in the early issues was all opinion, and we really didn't have, look for the sort of balance of fact, opinion, and analysis that we have now. Back then, it was really much more in the spirit of a zine, where we just wrote what we wanted to write. So certainly the scope of the magazine has broadened, and we print a lot of things that we wouldn't have printed earlier, you know, stuff that definitely reflects a broader readership, a readership that's getting older, more concerned with things like motherhood and different kinds of activism beyond what most people consider strictly feminist, you know, things like youth and prison rights, sustainable farming, things like that. So definitely the range of topics has evolved and broadened.
But I think they're kind of perennial. I mean, unfortunately, not enough has changed about the way women and feminists are being represented in popular culture that, you know, there are some topics that, unfortunately, as much as we would love to leave behind things about body image, things about sexual objectification, things about, I don't know.
Reproductive rights.
Yeah. I mean, we can't leave those behind because those are still battles to be fought. And, you know, as long as there are things that need to be commented on in those areas, we're going to be doing it.
I want to ask you guys about this cultural trend that I perceive that I thought was very interestingly described in one of the essays in the book, which was not written by either of you, as I recall. But there's an essay about the quote-unquote ironic T-shirts sold by, you know, mass-market retailers, Abercrombie and Fitch and American Eagle, I think, were the examples, that have, you know, racist slogans like, you know, Chinese dry cleaner, two wongs don't make a white, or something like that.
Yeah, two wongs will make it white, I believe.
Two wongs will. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
I hate to have nonsensical racism.
Yeah, well, you know, they do that too sometimes.
It feels like it's tied into me with a sort of culture where actual cultural criticism has in significant part been replaced by sort of snark, like a and that's something which, you know, I was really delighted in reading the book to not find, but it's something that's very easy to see if you turn on the television, you know, particularly with regard to, you know, celebrity culture or things like that. It seems like there's a lot of folks out there who are doing something that's really gross and then kind of half-assedly saying that they're doing it ironically or something like that. What's your perspective on that sort of part of the sort of under 40 culture?
Well, I think in a lot of ways it's a little bit of a logical result of a culture that really has come to devalue sincerity as something that's, you know, cheesy and hard to take seriously.
And embarrassing. Like, if
and
you're really sincere about something, you might get embarrassed, but if you are being sarcastic all the time, then you can always just play something off as like, oh, you didn't get my joke?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't mean that.
It's kind of a mass hipsterization of culture. And it's hard to really pinpoint how it started. I think that you could say that the internet has something to do with it. People's sense of fear has something to do with it. The phenomenon of adults sort of staying kind of arrested in a young adult phase and not wanting to grow up and sort of get square is a big part of it. And it's hard to know how all those things sort of politically fit together, but definitely the result has been the commercialization of a kind of sarcasm and, yeah, basically a sort of unwillingness to give in to sincerity, I guess.
I think there's also an element that people are very afraid to be accused of being sexist or racist, even though our culture is still very sexist and racist, and there are a lot of covert ways in which that's approved of and supported by the culture. Overt racism and sexism are now, you know, kind of unfashionable, but people haven't really done their work to become not racist and sexist, and so it's a way of protecting, like those kind of ironic t-shirts. It's a way of trying to be on the inside of a joke, whether you really are or are not. But wearing of those t-shirts, it kind of lets people partake in some of this race talk without having to take a stand one way or the other. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, it seems in a lot of ways to be kind of a way of allowing people to be contemptuous or negative about something that they're supposed to think is bad without actually doing. I think it was interesting that you used the word doing the work, without actually doing the work to make things better or even to make their own position or place in the world better.
Exactly. But it's very easy to defend yourself against charges of racism when it's about a t-shirt, because you can just be like, dude, can't you tell? It's ironic. It's an ironic t-shirt. This doesn't mean that I actually think that Asians should be doing laundry. And the fact that the stereotypes that the t-shirts play around with are so extreme, they're so archaic, that it is kind of like, well, I mean, of course this person doesn't really think that, so they must be really this this multiracial insider who doesn't have, you know, any racist thoughts ever, when in fact they just bought a t-shirt manufactured by a corporation.
It seems like it's also very easy to use that as a way to kind of blur the lines between, especially in terms of humor, in between things that are genuinely satirical and things that fall under the banner of, hey, I'm an equal opportunity offender.
Mm, exactly. And I think that's kind of the important part of these t-shirts, is that people aren't really thinking about what sort of message they're sending by wearing the t-shirt. They haven't really thought through the nuances between satire and just sort of dumb humor. Dumb racist humor. We really have sort of gotten lazy about our satire in this society. And so, unfortunately, you know, you get, comedians, magazines like Vice that rely on very sloppy shorthand, assuming that everyone's going to get the joke and not realizing that, in fact, most people, as Lisa said, haven't done the work and haven't really made the distinctions in their own mind between what's satire and what's just lazy stereotyping.
Andy, I want to ask you about a piece that you have in the book about women in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about what the impetus for that particular piece was, and how it kind of made you think about the way that women relate in the world of comedy.
Well, I mean, initially I wanted to write the piece because I've always loved comedy, and I come from a family who, you know, on family road trips would slap like a George Carlin tape in the tape player, or a Cheech and Chong tape. And we'd all laugh along about, like, the pot jokes and the curse words and stuff like that. But women always seemed like this kind of novelty subcategory. And I think what really got me thinking about it was I kept running into people who didn't think people like Janine Garofalo or Margaret Cho were funny. And these people were invariably men. And, you know, then digging a little deeper into it and actually reading interviews with these women, it turned out that, you know, that was kind of their lot. You know, comedy is a boys' club. And there was this idea that if a woman made a joke in a group full of men and the men didn't laugh, the idea was, well, the joke just wasn't funny. Whereas in a room full of women, it might have gotten a very different reaction, but because men are the dominant audience, they were the judges. And, you know, when you look at women's comedy, it really is very self-reflexive. You know, I saw Janine Garofalo a couple of times, and she's hilarious. But some of the funniest things she did were bits about her own, you know, kind of drug-related breakdowns or her body image or things like that. And if you look back in the history of women's comedy, that's kind of always been the case, is that women really turn their sharpest barbs on themselves. Men do that too, but you sort of see the power dynamics when you look at the differences between men's and women's comedy.
Well, and women tend to do it almost universally, whereas some male comedians do it and plenty of them don't.
Exactly.
And it's rare to see a female comedian who doesn't.
Why do you think that persists in, you know, 21st century America? It's so silly to say 21st century America, but in a world where half of the consumers are women, what is it that makes the cultural values of men stick more in the world of comedy?
I mean, that's a really good question, and I think the easy answer is just, well, there's just always been more of them, and so they've gotten to sort of set the rules, and women have had to either play along or risk sort of being ostracized and not getting their material out there, or, you know, being ghettoized as just a female comic, you know, which has certainly happened to a lot of women. I don't really know. I mean, I'm sure there's a huge amount of industry reasons for it, with things like bookers on comedy tours, agents, bookers at clubs, festivals like the Aspen Comedy Festival, you know, and then you certainly have old guard comedians making their views on female comics known. I mean, John Belushi refused to work with female comedians on Saturday Night Live. And so it's definitely still, it may not be as blatant anymore, but it's still there. You know,
just
when
a few years ago, Jerry Lewis made that comment
exactly.
Aspen about, what was it, that basically women should be home making babies and they weren't
funny.
Well,
he was asked who he thought were the funniest female comedians working today, and he said, you know what, I don't think of women as being funny. I think of them as producing machines that bring babies into the world. And, you know, I mean, whatever you think of Jerry Lewis, he has always been an industry force. And the fact that he said something that probably reflects what a lot of other comedians have felt, like, you know, as much as we sort of recoiled as a nation, there were probably a lot of people thinking, well, you know, I don't really think women are that funny either. But they had Jerry Lewis to validate it.
Well, Lisa, Andy, we're plumb out of time, but thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler are the co-editors of Bitch Fest, 10 Years of Cultural Criticism from the pages of Bitch Magazine, as well as the founding editors of that magazine. Well, that's about all the time we have for this week's Sound of Young America broadcast. I've been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our theme music was written and performed by Dan Grayson and myself. Incidental music on today's show by DJW. You can find bonus interview material from both our sets of guests on the blog at MaximumFun.org. We'll see you next week on the Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org.